Our next group of folks. As I mentioned earlier, when we were traveling around and having conversations with folks, oh yes, Jubilee is back, my co-host. So when we were doing this and we were talking about what we wanted to have conversations about, what do you think about this, what do you think about this, and we talked about the folks that we had on stage, the employers and the educator, Jubilee is like, I want to talk to them. So we're like, all right, you be my co-host. Yes. So here she is, our co-host, Jubilee, so welcome back. So as I mentioned before, these are some of the folks who are named as change makers, and we really wanted to have a conversation with them as well, too. So I want to introduce our next guest we have here, Clifton Phelps. He is the co-owner of JCP Construction. It's a black-owned construction company that he owns with his brother in Milwaukee. Brothers. And we have Anita Andrews Hutchinson, who is from Chicago, and she, along with two other sisters, opened up early learning centers in Chicago, Illinois. Let's give it up for Chicago. Let me go back, because I know that there are some Milwaukee folks in the room, and I'm just going to say Milwaukee. And then we have Dave Mullins, who is the Director of Business and Industry at Hutchinson Community College, and he works in a very unique space as well. He's a community college educator, but he also runs programs, degree-seeking programs inside minimum, medium, and maximum security prisons. So that's that. So. And then we have Jubilee. So I'm just going to start off, and I have one question, and I'm just going to toss it over to Jubilee. So as I mentioned before, you each occupy a unique space. Clifton, you and your brothers own a construction company, and so when we were doing our research, it's like 5% of construction firms in the United States are black-owned, 5%. Anita, you co-founded a network of early learning centers in Chicago, and less than 16% of them are black-owned, and most of those are home-based. Dave, in a completely different space, you lead business and industry courses at a community college in Hutchinson, but you teach these degree-earning college courses. The impacts of occupational segregation go beyond just the worker. When I talked about it, also impacts business owners. We talk about career navigation, the mobility, but also lateral moves and where job quality matters. But you guys are in spaces where you're owners and you're leaders, and you occupy a rare space. Can you talk about just some of the unique challenges being in the spaces that you are?
Yep. So I just want to add to that statistic about 5% being minority nationwide. Only 15% make it past 5 years. So out of that 5%, it even shrinks down to even more than that. And I'm just happy to be celebrating 15 years with my brothers and construction company that we built. Challenges from our end are access to contracts, access to capital, access to process, right? As well as access to good employees. If I could just go over to some of those points, access to contract is basically being able to be in the right room to get the contract and to understand what the industry is. Access to capital, line of credit, you know, we based off a 90-day pay salary, so if we're pumping out $190,000 a week in payroll, and we don't get it for 90 days, we're gonna need a line of credit, but that's hard to get line of credit because all those different KPIs the banking industry uses. The last one is process. In any industry, I don't care if it's a restaurant, I don't care what it is, if there's a lack of process, there's a lack of, you know, food delivery, then it means it's also a if there's a lack of process, then there's a lack of efficiency, which means there's a lack of profitability. So those are things that typically with family-run businesses that are passed on generation to generation. So as you know, entrepreneurs and business owners, if we don't have understanding how everything works, we tend to run out of business pretty quickly, and obviously growing employees. And you know, I want to give a shout out to Jerry Roberts here for bringing us here from Milwaukee Workforce Fund, as well as the National Fund for inviting us to here.
Also, Anita and I did not coordinate.
They did.
So I'm going to speak specifically about the challenges in correctional education. One of the biggest challenges is funding, right? So we are a second chance Pell school, so the folks that are taking classes with us are eligible for Pell grants. We'll transition into what will be called prison education programs over the next year and a half or so. That funding is used to be just only for second chance Pell schools, and now it is open up for everybody as long as they're a prison education program. So some of the, but the funding is not just, that's available, but it doesn't cover everything. Actually, for most students, it doesn't cover the full bill. So being able to cover that is one of the challenges. I think the other challenge is, in that environment, we're answering to a lot of different authorities, right? We've got to answer to the college and to, making sure that we're a creditable program, but also to the warden, right? And to the State Department of Correction. There's a whole lot of people that have, they're all aligned, but the interests mm-hmm. are a little bit different, sure. right? So that's a big challenge. And then, making sure that the students that we're working with see themselves as students and see themselves as employable when they get out, right? Mm-hmm. So those are some of the leadership challenges.
Thank you. First, I want to start off in gratitude and thanking the National Fund for having me here. And also a huge shout out to the Chicagoland workforce. Where are y'all? Okay, Bruce and Cindy, thank you for creating this opportunity. I think for us, it is three things: capital, talent, and enrollment. So capital, my best friend's mom, she took the plunge. She started our first early learning center by taking $40,000, her retirement fund, and opening the first early learning center because we didn't have access to resources. And when we added in our second and third early learning center, my dad did the same thing. He took out his retirement fund because, of the lack of access of capital. So resources. Second is the talent. I'm sure most of you all know that there is a teacher shortage across the nation, and we're affected by it. And so one of the things that we, in Chicago, we're in competition with our partners, which we love our partners, but they are able to pay their teachers more. They offer shorter days. They offer summers off. How can you compete with a summer off? And so it takes a village. We took a stake in the ground, and we committed to paying our teachers in parity with the local school council, local school district, which was a leap of faith. And we also added in PTO, and we also, we couldn't get that summer thing yet, but we're working on it. But that's talent, and so really creating a space where people are allowed to make a choice of the environment they want to work for, not just because of the different compensation. And then for enrollment, we are also, we have the same children, and, for families that can pay tuition at our schools, the local school district can allow families up to 400% of FPL to enroll for free, and we can only do that to 200%. And so there's a difference in, offering the opportunity for families to participate, so those three things.
Thank you. So my job for now is done. I'm going to hand it over to my co-host, Jubilee, because there are questions that she wanted to ask, and so who am I to stop her?
Yeah, of course. as leaders and educators in your community, what does mentorship mean to you all?
I'll start off. as an educator, I really believe that there is gold in our communities, and that gold is our people. All we have to do is, cultivate and create a pathway for people to see the opportunity. And so we have really decided that we, in investing in early learning, in early childhood education, in investing in loving and educating the youngest of our citizenry, then it allows us the opportunity to also work with their parents and their whole families. And so that has been our, that's how we've started to create a pathway to mentor. But it is, you know, we have the talent in our communities and we just have to create a pathway. So we did that in two ways. One was we are cradle to career. And so we have early learning centers, we have social justice elementary schools, and we have a wonderful workforce development program. We don't have a high school yet, we're still working on that, but that pathway has allowed us, this year, it's our 20th year, to have students who were in our toddler program, they've come back and they're teachers now. And so it's been a long road, but we wanted to create a cycle of cradle to career and create that opportunity at every step. The second way is our workforce development program. I'll just say this really quickly. We have six steps. One is just exposure. Two is an entry-level credentialing program through CDAs. Third is our cohorts model that we created for people who are in junior college or at a university. And then we also have our professional education license training program. So we help teachers get over that final hump so they can get higher wages because they're now they have a license. And then finally, offering gainful improvement.
So what does mentorship mean to me? I'm going to give a couple answers. One, we have some really formal mentorship arrangements with our apprenticeship programs that we have, right? So they're very formal. People are assigned particular people as a mentor. It's a very formal relationship. And then we have informal mentorships that are out there. So Andrew mentioned earlier, and very humbled that I was able to be part of Andrew's story and be an informal mentor to him. Another story related to correctional education. I had a gentleman stop by my office a few years ago, knocked on the door. I didn't recognize him. I wasn't his teacher. I was just an administrator. And he said, I just want to stop and say thank you, right? I was incarcerated at the Hutchinson Correctional Facility for 25 years. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was in my last year of incarceration, and all I could think of is how am I going to get back in, because this is the only life I know. And I took this class that you guys offered, and we call it a manufacturing skills certificate. It's really short. It's just 8 credit hours. It's not a whole certificate, whole degree program. And that he said, I took that, and I thought this is something I could do. I could see myself doing this job. And then I released, I got out, I got a job at a manufacturing company. It is a town about an hour away from Hutchinson. But I can pay my rent. I've got a place to go to work every day. It changed my life, right? And that's why we do what we do as educators, right? And to be able to have that impact on somebody was, you know, it's a beautiful thing, right? You've seen the same thing, Cliff, right?
Yeah, well, before we get to Cliff, because this is, you mentioned that story, but we also have someone, your mentee, who has a similar story about how he knocked on your door and how you rise to the occasion, right? So just appreciate your work in terms of mentorship. Full circle, yes.
Yeah, it's just, you never know when you might have that opportunity to mentor somebody, right? You know, it could be a chance conversation, and you just say the right thing, and you can, you know, the fact that you have the opportunity to do that, and you can change the course of somebody's life is wonderful. A stairway moment.
So, fun fact. I took my LSAT, and when I was an undergrad, and I got a pretty good LSAT score, so I thought I was going to be a lawyer. That didn't happen, right? But what it did do, it didn't happen. I called back to home because my dad had a stroke, but what door did open is I worked at a nonprofit. It's a nonprofit in Milwaukee called Running Rebels, and I learned for the next 4-year journey of what mentoring was, and I probably mentored close to maybe like 90 on a caseload. I was a case manager for them for a lot of youth that were essentially mandate reported to contact me every single day. And some of those relationships led to incarceration per my recommendation, and some relationships led to relationships that I have to this day with youth in the community. One of them is a developer that has developments. I called him Anthony when he was 16. He has developments close to like $124 million across the United States and as a developer. And when I always talk, I had lunch with him last week when he was in Milwaukee, and he was like, if you never were my caseworker, I don't know what I would have been. So mentor is important, I think, but most importantly about just in terms of the mentoring, it never leaves you, right? You're always gonna wait there to talk to someone. You always wanna strike up that conversation just in case that there's a cord alignment, just in case that there's synergies, and that's what happens when you kinda get inbred inside of mentor. The last point I'll put is, what we do every summer is that during the school year, we have lunch and learns with neighborhood schools. They come into our organization, we feed them lunch, we ask them questions, we kind of create connecting activities with them in small groups. We just had one last week, we got one planned for like next week. And it's not really just to convince them to come into construction, it's just because no one really opened the door for me at that age to come look inside and see what a business owner looks like and ask those questions. So the mentorship changes and evolves over those years, but the core principle of mentorship is caring about a generation or caring about a kid or caring about whoever is looking for help.
Great question, Jubilee.
We're gonna be switching up the flow and asking more individual questions. So I'll start off with Anita. In a space where only 60% of early learning centers are Black owned, how did you navigate becoming a co-founder of a large early learning center with multiple campuses around Chicago?
Great question. I think the first thing is just faith. When I was 19 years old, I asked, I was praying, and I was just like, Lord, just use me for your will, and, whatever that path is, I'm going to be faithful, and I'm going to travel on it. And so that has been kind of my guiding star for the work that I do. And then, just in terms of practicality, I quit medical school too, so we have that in common, but that's another story. Anybody want drinks? We'll do that later. But in that, when I was studying for my USMLEs, because I was doing a lot of mentorship, I was doing a lot of community work, and I was just like, you know what, when I pass this test, I'm not going to be able to work with these young people anymore. And I was just like, you know what, maybe, I've invested a lot of time and a lot of money into, borrowed money, into this field, but maybe this isn't my path. And so it was just, that fortitude, the courage that I think my parents instilled in me to pivot. And sometimes life, you have to pivot. And so, I changed gears and I went into early child education, but my, all my whole life was in medicine. But I was like, I'm good at math. I can balance some budgets and I can, write a business proposal. And so tapping into, and then researching and knowing that you're not the only one. And so connecting to the Chicago Women's Business Development Corporation was a key because they believed in us and they put us on in a connection, a place where we could get a small loan to kind of continue the pathway. I think just my parents, Gwen, who did take the first plunge and invest her retirement plan. I mean, that's a leap of faith. You know what I'm saying? So I think faith just kind of permeates the work that we do, and always being gracious in gratitude for the opportunities that present themselves.
Such an impactful story. Dave, what challenges do you face in helping to prepare your justice-involved students for the challenges they'll face seeking work once they're released?
So some of the challenges with our correctional students, right, is identity, right? The society calls them convicts, right? Sometimes within the system, they're referred to either as offenders or more kindly as residents sometimes. But we identify them as students, right? When they're with us, they're students, right? And so that's a big part of it, right? I mean, that's kind of a first step that they while they're with us, they see themselves as students. We also then We've got two educational navigators. We have 100 students a year that pursue their GEDs, and we've got about 120 students a year that are in post-secondary education. So we've got two educational navigators that help navigate that process, right? I'm sticking with that navigation theme here. We also then bring in speakers to the classes. We've got some employers that will come in and talk about what their journey was and how, you know, it wasn't a smooth path, you know, things that were, I thought I was going to do this and then I had to pivot and do that. We've got our apprenticeship coordinator that'll come in and talk to all of our classes about here are some opportunities that are out there and here are especially companies or industry segments that are very second chance friendly. And then we have a career services coordinator. It's a new position for the college, but one of the things that person will do is come in and speak to the students as well. And we have planned for this year that we'll do a career fair, right? So like the job fair we have on the outside at our sports arena, we have lots of employers come to that. We'll do I'm sure it'll be a smaller version, but it'll be a chance for students to talk to employers and see what opportunities that are out there. So those are some of the things that we do.
I just want to say thank you so much for the amazing work that you do. It sounds really fulfilling and it sounds really impactful. So I hope people that are watching and people here really do hear the work that he's doing and appreciate him for it.
Yeah, I have a great team.
That's great. And Cliff, you did mention that you own a construction company with your brothers in a space where only 5% of construction companies are black owned.
Yep.
Tell us about your story.
So the story starts of three brothers not really liking their jobs. And we were sitting upstairs from our parents' house, they have a duplex. We're like, man, if we can just work less hours and own our own business. And it was that was our thought process. So we wanted to work less hours, but now we work more hours than everyone in the office. So, but I think in terms of like the journey, I think the journey evolves, you know, as just trying to navigate everything throughout. Luckily, it's three of us. We all have three different skill sets. We all give three different answers up here, which helps us kind of scope the board a lot more and do what everyone's good at in terms of how to grow the company. I think in terms of our biggest thing that we had to kind of figure out maybe like 8 years ago was let's stop trying to create our own thing and let's figure out what other companies are doing out here and let's mimic that, you know. And that's leaning on resources and that's kind of understanding how business in itself go. We didn't want to be that failing company. We wanted to make it over our 5-year hump, our 10-year hump. Made it to our 15-year hump, so we just got to kind of figure out and start to look at the next generation. But I think in overall for the company, it's something that I think hopefully my story, anyone can reach out to me in terms of what that looks like for any of those pillars that I talked about, because they are challenges and they are the death of most companies. But I think the best satisfaction I have is our employees. Tracy was up here earlier today. We call her Mama Carson, or Sister Carson. She plays a whole tambourine in the office. It's very relieving. But it's satisfying to employ some of the best employees that we have that work for our company, and just to get to where we are. When I think about just overall working with family, my brothers being a family-owned business again, or a family-owned business, especially an African-American one, it's really something that we actually have to wake up every day and kind of pinch ourselves about. Definitely challenges, but you know, challenges that maybe took 3 months before probably take a day, you know, a week now, and,
right.
And you know, we just kind of work our way through everything. That clock is, I'm a minute over. Huh?
It is.
All right. I was wondering why she was sitting up.
It is okay. Look, we knew, I mean, every time we have these state of the work conversations, people always want more and more and more because there's lots that we can talk about. So thank you to all of you
thank
guys,
you.
But also our co-host, Jubilee. ends our State of the Workforce podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today. And for those of you who are on LinkedIn Live, please make sure to follow the National Fund and stay up to date with all the latest from State of Our Workforce. You can find us at any podcasting streaming station that you listen to. So tune in next month as we continue the conversation. But before I go, I want to do a few shout outs to the folks who made some of this work possible. Our career navigation team, Jordan Dolphy. Yes. Michelle Rafferty, Josh Enoch, Jessica Jones, as well as Karan Campbell and Brittany Cord. Shout out to them. Our collaborative SkillWorks Boston, Central 6 Alabama Works, Chicagoland Workforce Funder Alliance, Milwaukee Area Workforce Funding Alliance, and the Workforce Alliance of South Central Kansas. I also want to thank Patty Constantakis with Walmart, who sponsored this work and helped put us on the path around the career navigation conversations. And so in the words of the greatest to ever do it, you could have been anywhere in the world, but you are here with us. We appreciate that. That's Jigga Jay-Z Ho.
State of Our Workforce, Where Are We Now? Is a production of the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. This episode was produced by Josh Enoch. The music in this episode is produced by Alex Productions. You can find past episodes of State of Our Workforce on our website at www.nationalfund.org. State of Our Workforce is also available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you may listen. State of Our Workforce airs live monthly on LinkedIn. Follow the National Fund for Workforce Solutions on LinkedIn to get updates about the next live recording of State of Our Workforce.